Hello, it's John Dennis here on Friday, November the 7th.
With Gordon Brown, Britain is strong. With Gordon Brown, Labour has won here in Glenrothes and Central Fife.
Today, the first real evidence of the Brown bounce as Labour wins the Glenrothes by-election. Also today, the transition from Bush to Obama begins as the president-elect puts together his White House team.
Sometimes it works well and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it can be extremely awkward. It depends on the personalities of the president and the president-elect.
And there's shock as the Bank of England slashes interest rates to 3%.
We really need rates at 2%. They've got them down to 3%. Great move.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis. On guardian.co.uk.
But first, the news headlines and a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
World stock markets are slumping again. The sense of recession has seriously affected trading. The IMF predicted the developed economies of the world will shrink during the next year. In spite of a 1.5% cut in bank lending rates, the British market dropped by nearly 6%. The US market ended down nearly 5%. The Asian markets have been sinking by as much as 7% during their trading day. The Japanese central bank followed Britain and Europe by cutting its bank lending rate. European ministers will meet today in Brussels to discuss the economy. Labour have surprisingly won the Scottish by-election at Glenrothes, though there was a swing to the Scottish National Party of more than 4%. It's a personal victory for Gordon Brown, whose constituency borders Glenrothes. It's also seen as a sign that Mr Brown's handling of the economy during the present turmoil has improved his party's standings. Both Brown and his wife went campaigning in the by-election. In Congo, more fighting has led to more deaths. Aid officials travelling the war zone continue to find the bodies of civilians who've been killed. UN peacekeeping soldiers have also had to get involved in the battles. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called for an immediate ceasefire. He's joining leaders of the African Union at a summit today to discuss the conflict in Nairobi. President-elect of the USA, Barack Obama, is expected to meet his economic team today. He's to give his first news conference and may announce who will be his new Treasury Secretary. He'll meet George Bush at the White House on Monday to discuss the economy and foreign policy. But he's reported to have refused an invitation to attend an international summit of the 20 richest nations. We'll have more on Obama's team building later in Guardian Daily. Football and Harry Redknapp's transformation of Tottenham Hotspur since he took over as manager builds. Tottenham smashed Dinamo Zagreb 4-0, but there were other good results in the UEFA Cup matches last night. Manchester City won 3-2 and Aston Villa beat Slavia Prague 1-0. In the papers, The Guardian gets the late news onto its front pages with the headline, "Shock victory puts the bounce back into Brown." It then passes to the main story shared with almost all the other front pages about the huge cut in bank interest rates. Rates fall to 54-year low, trumpets the Financial Times, but it moves straight to the effect on our bailed-out banks. All but two snubbed government calls to pass on the dramatic interest rate cuts. The Times says that the banks were urged to pass on the cuts. The Independent says they were ordered to. But when they said they wouldn't cut, the Mail complains of the shame of the banks because mortgage giants, yes, even those bailed out by taxpayers, axe their best deals. And the Sun grunts angrily, "Now pass it on, you bankers." Otherwise, there are friendly pictures of a very stylish Barack Obama in tracksuit, dark glasses and trainers on his way to a workout at the gym. President of Cool, the Mirror calls him. The Guardian asks whether the Terminator, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, might get into Obama's cabinet as energy secretary. And the Times has a black and white photo of Michelle Obama to go with an article by her describing how she'll use her time in the White House to help working women and families. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
This is the result of the parliamentary by-election held on Thursday, the 6th of November 2008, for a member to serve in Parliament for the Glenrothes constituency. Maurice Charles Golden, Scottish Conservative and Unionist Party, 1,381 votes. Peter Grant, Scottish National Party, 13,209 votes. Lindsay Roy, Scottish Labour Party, 19,946 votes.
Gordon Brown himself campaigned in Glenrothes for Labour. That shows just how important it was for him to retain the seat for Labour. Labour will point to this victory as evidence of the brown bounce, a revival in the Prime Minister's fortunes, fuelled by his adept handling of the economic crisis. Our senior political correspondent, Andrew Sparrow, is in Glenrothes.
Their majority was actually 6,737, and this was in a seat where they had a majority of more than 10,000 at the general election. So on paper, that looks like a modest disappointment. But you've got to remember that many people in the party had convinced themselves they were going to lose and possibly lose quite badly. The SNP, the challengers, were pretty adamant that they were going to win, and most of the journalists who've been following this contest were also convinced that they were going to lose too. So a victory of one would have been a defeat against expectations, but a victory by almost 7,000 is frankly a fantastic result for Labour. My strong sense is that it has very little to do with Gordon Brown's handling of the financial crisis over the last sort of 5 weeks, which has got the plaudits down in Westminster. Glenrothes is in an area where the SNP run the council. They've run it since last May. And the SNP candidate, Peter Grant, is leader of the council. So Labour were able to effectively fight this seat as the challengers, as the opposition. They concentrated their campaign on issues to do with the council, particularly its decision to raise charges of people who, some people who use the home care services up here. SNP said actually most people aren't having to pay more. Charges are only being levied on people who can afford to pay. But Labour ran a sort of classic opposition style campaign that they kind of focused on the SNP administration in Fife, not just in Scotland, because remember the SNP ran Scotland too. They focused on what the council was doing, said that, look, they've taken this unpopular decision. If you're unhappy about it, vote for us as a protest vote. And it definitely seems to have worked.
Does Labour's victory in Glenrothes mean that Gordon Brown could still hold a majority at the next general election?
Well, it's very difficult to read across, because essentially this is a fight between Labour and the SNP, and the SNP sort of don't contest seats in England and Wales. There was a modest swing to the SNP, and the Labour vote went up slightly, but the SNP went up by far more. The Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives more or less got sort of wiped out. Their votes got completely squeezed. The Liberal Democrats were down into three figures. So, I mean, if you try to project the results of that on a national scale, it would probably mean the SNP picking up one or two extra seats in Scotland. I haven't seen figures that might be higher or lower than that, and nothing else much changing in England. But, of course, in England, the Conservatives are fighting Labour. The SNP don't run many councils in England, so the Labour aren't going to be able to run the sort of campaign they did up here. Gordon Brown, in one sense, this election shows that it's hard to win an election when you're the incumbent. In general, Gordon Brown is going to have to fight the next election as the incumbent. What I am pretty sure about is that a lot of Labour MPs who have been worrying about whether their party can win anywhere until recently, going to look at this and think, well, actually, sort of, we can. We're not out of the game yet by any means.
Andrew Sparrow talking to Guardian Daily's Ben Green. And there's full coverage of the Glenrothes by-election at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, Emily Bell says Hazel Blears has demonstrated how Labour just doesn't get the web as a tool of political communication. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. Michael Rosen and Anushka Ravishankar on writing for children in a multicultural world at guardian.co.uk/books. And the film and music supplement in today's Guardian newspaper focuses on jazz. Can you learn to understand jazz in just 6 weeks? Our rock critic Alexis Petridis took a crash course. He discovered it's not wise to mock the work of John Coltrane. Quite right too. All that jazz and more, including some free downloads at guardian.co.uk/music. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee cut interest rates yesterday from 4.5% to 3%, a cut of 1.5%. The move followed the emergency half-point cut the bank made in concert with other central banks around the world amid last month's turmoil in the banking system. Ashley Seeger, our economics correspondent, says it's a bold move and the right one.
Absolutely, completely. I'm very impressed that they've cut so far. I never thought they had it in them to cut so far. But clearly rates at 4.5%, as I've said before, in an economy going down the Swanee as quickly as this one is, was totally inappropriate. We really need rates at 2%. They've got them down to 3%. Great move.
How much of a shock was yesterday's decision?
In retrospect, I'm kicking myself. I think perhaps I should have seen it, because I did know there'd been discussion sort of within the bank about where the appropriate level of rates rather than how much they needed to be cut by. So when they went 150 basis points, I suddenly thought maybe I should have seen that coming. So it was totally unexpected. The trade unions had called for 150 basis points, but I don't think they had any idea that they were going to be rewarded with a cut like that. So completely unexpected. Biggest cut since 1981, lowest level since 1954. We're in new territory now.
What does it tell us about the state of the economy?
It tells us that the economy is in very, very bad shape. We had numbers again yesterday. Halifax house prices are down 15% year on year. That's more in 1 year than they'd fallen in the whole of the last housing slump. Don't forget, bad numbers. New car sales down 23%. New construction orders down 20%. The economy is in a horrible state. We've been saying this for months and months, and often people just wouldn't listen to us, but the economy's in a horrible state. The Bank of England's done its analysis for its quarterly inflation report that we get next Wednesday. It's obviously run the numbers through its models and thought, crikey, we better cut rates.
And could rates be cut further?
Oh, absolutely. I think we're only halfway to where we're going. I think 2%, 1.5%, 1%. This is the sort of area we're going to by the spring, by the early summer.
Gordon Brown has repeatedly urged the banks to pass Bank of England rate cuts on to consumers. Will they do that this time?
That's a very interesting question. Clearly, consumers who are or mortgage holders who are on floating rate debt, generally they will get that passed on to them. The fuss has all been about new borrowers who are not getting tracker rates passed on to them and so on and so forth. Now, I'm not sure how big a problem that is, because there aren't any new borrowers, because no one's buying a house. Why would you? They're falling 2.2% a month, as the Halifax told us yesterday. For me, consumers will be all right. Those who've got a mortgage with a tracker, they're going to get substantial reductions in monthly payments. That'll help boost confidence. It'll help boost spending in the shops, probably. Will it get lending going to small businesses, medium-sized businesses? That, for me, is the problem in this economy. That's what the Treasury is worried about. That's what the bank's worried about. Businesses cannot get access to credit. We're in trouble here. The bank has belatedly recognised that.
And the bank cut will help Britain pull its way out of the recession.
Well, it should do, yes. I mean, I think rates will have to go down somewhat further, as I've said, but it's a powerful weapon, interest rates. I mean, I know some of the MPC have said, oh, well, perhaps the power of the weapon's been blunted by banks not passing it on everywhere. That's true. But if that is true, then you must make bigger cuts to hope that some of it gets through, and that's what they've done.
Is there any downside to the interest rate cut?
There is if you're a saver. Certainly, you'll be cross at seeing your savings rate being cut, and there are an awful lot of savers, particularly amongst Guardian readers, I have to say. There is, interestingly, a lot of people said if you cut rates too far, you'll undermine the pound and it'll fall. My argument is the pound has been falling sharply because the bank has not cut rates, and everyone and international investors have thought, oh heavens, the UK looks in real trouble, I'm going to sell the pound. In fact, the pound went up quite strongly against the dollar and the euro. FTSE recovered a lot of its losses because markets thought, great, the Bank of England's on the team, they're doing the business, they're trying to shore up this rapidly weakening economy. So for me, there's only upside at the moment, unless you're a saver, of course.
Ashley Seeger. My name's John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, Britain faces a glut of heroin on its streets after a record harvest of opium in Afghanistan. That's according to an EU report. It says the UK uses more cocaine than anywhere else in Europe.
10 years ago, one would have spent nearly 80, 85, maybe £100 a gram. Probably get a gram now for between £30 and £40.
But first, President-elect Barack Obama has begun selecting the people who will serve in his White House team when he takes over on January the 20th. The outgoing president, George Bush, has pledged to make the process as easy as possible. Ewan McCaskill, our Washington correspondent, says the next 2 months will be crucial for Obama.
Barack Obama is expected to release sort of over the next few days and weeks the names of all the sort of key players in the administration, you know, from the White House Chief of Staff all the way through to Treasury, Defence Secretary of State, and who's going to, you know, of interest to journalists anyway, is who's going to be the White House press officer.
It's a curious process, this process of transition, isn't it? How does it work?
Well, it's a good question because sometimes it works well and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it can be extremely awkward. It depends on the personalities of the president and the president-elect. George Bush yesterday promised that he would make his priority for his sort of remaining sort of 73, 74 days in office. He would make the priority making the transition as smooth as possible. You know, whether in reality it happens like that, he did say that he'd instructed all his staff from the CIA through to the Justice Department and others in the executive office to brief Obama and give his transition team all the help they needed.
The early months of Bill Clinton's presidency weren't very happy. How will Obama attempt to avoid the pitfalls facing President Clinton?
Bill Clinton had a really sort of torrid start. Even though he had a Congress that was basically favourable to him in terms of numbers, Clinton's background wasn't in Congress. He was sort of governor of Arkansas. Maybe he was a bit too arrogant in his the way he behaved towards the legislators. So it was an unhappy start. Barack Obama's from the Senate. He surrounded himself with Vice President Joe Biden, who knows the Congress inside out, and he has others in his team. So I think we'll see, maybe Obama's sort of looked at history and seen what's happened to Clinton, and is determined not to repeat those mistakes.
Well, as Obama decides on how he proposes to govern America, the Republican Party's licking its wounds. How has this defeat of John McCain left the Republicans?
It's left them all at sea. I mean, they don't have a leader. And this, it's not just that the Tuesday night results were bad. They come and talk of the defeat in 2006 and the midterm congressional elections. So this is sort of two consecutive defeats. So they're having to come to terms with that. I spoke to some Republicans yesterday and they were driving out of Washington. They were going to a remote location in the Shenandoah Valley. And that was sort of people from the about 20 people from the conservative wing of the party. And this is, I think, probably the first inquest that's underway. The main focus is on who's going to be the next leader of the Republican Party. So there's a battle underway. They are not presidential candidate, but just the actual sort of like the chairman of the party. And then the big battle is for the soul of the party. There's people on the conservative wing think the party should go more to the right, should be sort of faithful to its conservative principles. Other people say, well, that costs you the election. You've got to move to the centre. So we're going to have this huge ideological battle underway. We'll see more of that next week when the governors, Republican governors, meet in Miami. And they're some of the most senior Republicans around. And on that agenda is what went wrong in the election and how do we rebrand the party to ensure we don't get beaten next time.
Ewan McCaskill in Washington. Well, Barack Obama doesn't need to look far to find some tough challenges to US foreign policy. Dmitry Medvedev, in his first State of the Nation address as Russian president, lambasted the United States for what he says was its arrogant course of action and its unilateralism. The Guardian's Luke Harding is in Kaliningrad. He told me how Medvedev responded to Obama's election.
Well, to be honest, he didn't really respond. We were quite surprised because Barack Obama had been elected a couple of hours earlier and Dmitry Medvedev then stood up in the Kremlin to speak, addressing a whole crowd of Russian dignitaries and Vladimir Putin, of course, his predecessor as president. And he didn't say anything about Obama's victory at all. Instead, he said two things which were rather stunning. First of all, that he proposed extending the presidential term in Russia for 4 to 6 years, which many people here see as a sort of ploy for Vladimir Putin to return to the Kremlin possibly very soon. And he also said that Russia was going to deploy nuclear-capable Iskander missiles in its western enclave of Kaliningrad to kind of zap the American missiles, which are being interceptors, being are going to be sighted in Poland and the Czech Republic, to zap them out of the sky.
Now, dealing with the second of those points first, you're in Kaliningrad, Luke, and that's where these missiles would be situated.
Yeah, this is all very interesting, and I have to say, rather reminiscent of the Cold War. I mean, the Cold War, you had, of course, Warsaw Pact countries like communist East Germany and the Czech Republic, which were you know, bristling with sort of Soviet short-range missiles, pointed, of course, to Western Europe and to Britain and so on. And now, really, what we're seeing is a kind of repeat of this, with this kind of Cold War infrastructure being deployed again, with the Americans citing their bases in Poland and the Czech Republic, which are now, of course, both NATO countries, and the Russians responding by plonking their short-range missiles in Kaliningrad, which used to belong, of course, to Germany and is now Russian.
So a big foreign policy headache for President Obama.
I think reading on the Guardian website that after Obama was told of the foreign policy challenges, he sort of exclaimed, you know, God, why did I apply for this job? And I think very top of the intro is what to do with Russia, what to do with this assertive, bellicose, and increasingly kind of angry Kremlin that really is just not convinced by the Bush administration's sort of protestations that this missile defense scheme is directed at crazy Iranians and the Iranian regime and not at Russia. And, you know, the Kremlin is basically saying, okay, you do this, we're going to deploy, you know, nuclear missiles in Western Europe just like in the good old days.
Now, dealing with the other point that President Medvedev raised in his State of the Nation speech, Luke, that you mentioned, constitutional changes that could see Putin return as Russia's president. How would that work?
Some analysts were already talking last night about Vladimir Putin being the leader of Russia until 2024, by which time all of us will be very old indeed or advanced into middle age, and Putin will be, I think, 70, if I've worked that out correctly. Basically, what President Medvedev proposed was an idea floated when Putin was president, that the presidential term was extended to 6 years. He said this was to guarantee stability, but of course, many people here, critics of the regime, say that this is to avoid the embarrassment of elections, which really in Russia are something of a joke, to put it mildly, that they're essentially decorative rather than real. But the scenario is that Putin could return in 2012 when Medvedev quits office. Possibly he could even return next year, and he would then serve 2 6-year stints.
Luke Harding. A glut of opium on the world market, fuelled by a record Afghan harvest, threatens a new heroin crisis in Britain. The warning came in the annual report by the European Drug Agency. It says that for the fifth year running, more cocaine is being consumed in Britain than anywhere else in Europe. Andrew Horn is Director of Operations for Scotland for the drug and alcohol treatment charity Ad Action.
First thing is it's a weighty report. Each time it comes out, it seems to get bigger and bigger. There's some major highlights to the report that came out yesterday. I suppose the first thing of most concern for the UK is that we come top of the league in terms of cocaine use among young people and young adults.
Why is cocaine use so high in Britain?
Difficult to say. There's huge availability. It's got much cheaper. It keeps going. It's a deflationary drug. It goes down in price year on year. 10 years ago, one would have spent merely 80, 85, maybe £100 a gram. Probably get a gram now for between £30 and £40. So one is its cheapness. Two is availability, because there's just so much more of it around. Three is, I think, it's a drug of choice among a lot of young people. Maybe people who have seen communities, you know, destroyed by heroin use, think, oh, well, this is a different, safer drug, and, you know, misguided in much of that. Four is, I think, it's a drug seen as being less harmful and used in terms of as a social drug. And five, it is used by people who already have heroin problems, and they double up on their drug use.
And there's also a glut of heroin on the world market. There have been two record opium harvests in Afghanistan. How can the UK protect itself against that?
That's very difficult. As a treatment organisation, that's difficult for us to say, because we're not really involved in enforcement and border control. You know, we're far away from that. What we see is the consequences of that. What that means for us is that if there are steady supplies for heroin, and there has been for the last few years, and that looks to increase again next year, people are less likely to be inclined to go into treatment, which is a real worry for us, because, you know, when there are droughts in heroin, supply, then people do think, oh, well, I don't have anywhere to score. I can't, you know, I haven't got any access to more money because price goes up and stuff. And so they do say, well, maybe I should get myself together. So what it does is, with high availability, again, one could see a lowering price, although that doesn't happen much with heroin. It's very static. But one might see it with a major glut. But the big consequence is people are less likely to want to go into treatment.
The EU agency did say, though, that there were signs that, although a quarter of all Europeans have tried cannabis, its use was declining across Europe. Is that your experience?
Our experience, well, in our young people service, in our young people ad action services, it's still really a drug of choice. You know, it's still one of the first drugs around. Certainly here in Scotland, it's still very popular among young people and across all communities and all sections of our communities. So I don't think we have much evidence base of that. We would have to go back into our own recording and delve further into that. But from our experience, no, we wouldn't. That doesn't feel real for us at this moment.
What does this report say about drug-related deaths?
Well, unfortunately, we've seen another rise across the UK and a significant rise here in Scotland with regards to drug-related deaths. It tends to be heroin use. There's some mention of methadone use being quite high up there. The one bit that the report doesn't deal with, because it only concerns itself with illicit drug use, is the amount of diazepam present in drug-related deaths. So that, because it's a prescription drug, it doesn't show very highly. The other thing that the report does suggest quite strongly is that the highest risk group tends to be men leaving prison, or certainly men who have left prison within the last 3 months. So we have to be absolutely 100% tight in our true care arrangements from prison back into the community and make sure that there's no breakdown in treatment.
Andrew Horn from Ad Action. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard, Tim Mabey, and in Washington, Francesca Panetta. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.